This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Tom Zacharias, President of the National Crop Insurance Services. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance, Family Farming Legacies, American Manufacturing Jobs, and our national food security needs strong farm and trade policies. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Tom Zacharias next. American sugar beet and sugarcane farmers are keeping grocery store shelves stocked this holiday season with American-made sugar while supporting more than 151,000 jobs and contributing $23.3 billion in annual economic activity. Family Farming Legacies, American Manufacturing Jobs, and our national food security need strong farm and trade policies. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. With increased weather extremes and economic volatility, farmers and ranchers rely heavily on the nation's crop insurance system to help manage risk. National Crop Insurance Services President Tom Zacharias says crop insurance is not a government program.
It's a public-private partnership, and it's been that way since about 1980 when private sector companies became involved in the writing of this business with USDA. And it's been a partnership that has grown tremendously, definitely since 1980. And we'll do a little history here just for grins. It's important to realize that there was an underlying crop hail industry to begin with, where you had companies involved writing hail business with agents and adjusters. And as the federal crop insurance program was taken two steps back, one step forward, there came a realization that the private industry could be employed and incentivized to write this business with the support of USDA in the public sector. And that's where the ball really gets rolling in 1980, and it's been taking off ever since.
So how has crop insurance evolved over a period of time, and is it able to keep up with the needs of crop farmers today?
Yeah, absolutely. If you look back, let's try to get off the 80s into the 90s, et cetera, the program, you know, sort of leaps and starts, and there's a clear recognition, okay, if you take agricultural policy, government is going to be involved in agriculture in one form or another, okay? Societies that are vibrant and thrive have, you know, strong agricultural economies to feed their populations as well as others. And so recognition of the, you know, strength of the public sector and what it brings to the table, and then the blending of that with the private sector, the innovation, the ability to be quick on your feet, to respond to what's going on in the marketplace, what's going on with respect to changing weather conditions. Just sort of a natural evolution, as it were. It rocked along until, say 1993, when we had serious floods and excessive moisture all through the Midwest. And as a result of that, there was the 1994 Crop Insurance Reform Act that for farmers to receive USDA benefits, they had to start enrolling in crop insurance. And so then that springboarded a little forward into your question or issue about responding to economic events. It was in the late 90s when the revenue products came into existence, and that was a recognition that there was not only yield and weather risk, but market uncertainty as well, and private sector brought to the table some alternatives for managing the revenue risk associated with crop farm business, particularly in the Midwest, corn and soybean folks, and that was a tremendous tremendous gain to the program, really increased participation quite a bit. going back to weather risk, you got 2011, 2012, where you had a situation, particularly in 11, where you had two situations of flooding up and down I-29. Then you had the series of droughts in the Southern Plains. Crop insurance handled both of those. 2012, the major drought there. No calls for ad hoc disaster. Program performed admirably, which leads into 2014-2017. And you get the boost from those farm bill legislation, that farm bill legislation that expanded the program even further. So, and then we'll somewhere soon we're going to turn a corner and we're going to get to OB3, which is just another recognition of this progression of what crop insurance brings to the table for American farmers and ranchers.
Being a farm kid in the 70s and 80s, I can recall Dad saying that if you could afford crop insurance, you didn't need it. But we have proven the relationship of the insurance provider and of the farmer paying premiums and also the taxpayer support. So what role has the subsidy level that makes crop insurance affordable done to help preserve the industry, preserve farms, and also give Washington a little better handle on working through the challenges that farmers are facing from Mother Nature?
Everybody that you interview probably has their three-legged stool. So here's mine. For crop insurance, I think there's three things. There's availability of crop insurance. There's affordability of crop insurance. And then there, with respect to the public-private partnership, the viability of the private sector to have an adequate rate of return to run this business. And so when you take the availability and affordability aspects by providing premium support to farmers, that is, encourages them to buy the proper amount of coverage, adequate coverage, to stave off ad hoc disaster, to cover their costs when, you know, you have a situation like you did in 2012, or you had a situation like you had the hurricanes the last couple of years down in the southeast. Because of the crop insurance system that we have in the U.S., those claims are turned around in less than 30 days, and farmers know where they stand for the next growing season. So again, because it's widely available nationwide, we've got, over 400 million acres insured. Coverage levels are in excess of 70% nationwide, which is a remarkable statistic in and of itself. So we have wide-scale availability because of the premium support. You've got affordability. Farmers can buy into this. And the private sector delivers this effectively. Make sure these guys have crossed the T's, dotted the I's on these policies. And the ag business can keep on churning.
I saw some survey results earlier this year. 90% of farmers have bought crop insurance repeatedly. Five out of the past 5 years. Do you see any change in farmers supporting for the program?
You know, actually, with the introduction of OB3 and the changes there in premium support, I think it's going to go in an upward direction. There were, in that legislation, increases on individual coverages in terms of premium support, and then the area plans, the index plans, increased premium support there. The idea being that if there is wide-scale participation in crop insurance, then that would mitigate the need for ad hoc disaster. The hurricane program down in the southeast is a great example of that, where in the course of 15 to 20 days, 2 years ago, I believe, $700 million of indemnities flows back into the system. Again, people are incentivized to purchase crop insurance. It makes perfect business sense. Lenders required in many cases. And you take the conditions in the current farm economy, to farm without insurance is just not a good idea.
Some regions collect more often than others. Some farmers collect more often than others. And crop insurance is not free, even with the subsidy. Do you see a move by any particular areas where farmers are choosing to save the premium and self-insure?
You know, there may be some of that, but I think in total, I think farmers have confidence in the system that we have. We have an excellent agency force out there delivering this program to the farmers. Got probably 12,000 agents nationwide. And farmers may consider, you know, looking over the fence every once in a while and wondering. But at the level of premium support and the service, again, going back to how fast these claims are paid, my gosh, within 30 days or 15 to 20 days, that amount of dollars going out, take 2019 prevented planting in the Midwest, South Dakota, Illinois, et cetera. Those states, Jeff, prevented planting that year was about $4.2 billion in indemnities, all right, through the public-private partnership. And then RMA and USDA determined that they were going to top that off a little bit because of the severity of the losses. And there was another just under $600 million delivered by October-ish. So when you think of alternatives, what would someone have in mind that can surpass those metrics?
Obviously, a relationship between the approved insurance providers and the agents that are across the country serving farmers. Have you seen a consolidation?
Yes, I haven't seen it so much on the agent side because I don't look at those numbers a lot. There's two drivers there. One, let's take the AIP side, the company side, folks that pay our salary. There's two aspects of that. There is a scale and spread. Okay. The program, offers, you know, a multitude of combinations. You've got, 3,000 counties in the U.S. You have that times the number of crops times different types of crop insurance plans. So there's a vast array of risk management alternatives that are available. And for a company to operate effectively nationwide, they've got to have scale of operation. The other side of this is the amount of risk that's involved at about $18 billion of premium. That's about $200 billion in liability or risk that's out there. Companies have to have spread. You know, you mentioned different regions. You know, some years are better than others in certain places, obviously. For a company to survive at a national level and, or, you know, to prosper at a national level, they've got to have both spread and scale.
Commodity prices are down and input costs are up, and a lot of spreadsheets across the country going into 26 are looking at red ink. How does crop insurance work in a scenario like this? There are those who have said that crop insurance guarantees farmers profit. I don't see that as viable in 25 or even 26.
No, and that's not the purpose of crop insurance. Purpose of crop insurance is to be there when there's an insurable loss under the policy. The indemnity dollars that go out are basically designed to cover the farmer's costs to get them to the next year. We did a little informal work internally, and you can take crop combinations, Nebraska corn, Georgia cotton, etc., go down the list of a few of those, and you can find where the basic coverage, 75% coverage, 65% coverage in some cases, will cover a good chunk of variable costs and even into the total cost of the operation. So the other side of that is, you know, there has to be an insurable event for that to trigger an indemnity. To the larger farm economy issue of, you know, the price doldrums that we're in and the uncertainty we face in that, crop insurance, we have the within season revenue protection, but that's the purpose of Title I programs, to provide the support on the price side when these markets are in the shape that they're in.
Tom, what was in H.R. 1 that was a benefit for growers, providing more affordable, higher levels of coverage?
Yeah, I think on individual coverages, there was like 3 to 5 points, depending upon coverage level, of increased premium support. For the area-based, I think that went from up to about 80% increased premium support there. So those are pretty substantial. You should see increases in buy-up coverage in some areas. And with the supplementals, an uptake in participation of those.
Tom, in the 80s, we lost a generation of young farmers. And certainly there are no shortage of challenges now. Within that legislation that was approved this summer, what about young and beginning farmers? Was there support there to extend assistance for them to survive?
Absolutely. Beginning farmer and rancher provisions were enhanced. Increased premium support was extended to folks that qualify or eligible for that. So going back to that three-legged stool, availability, affordability, and viability, the reconciliation bill addressed the particular beginning farmer and rancher thing specifically in those provisions, as well as other areas of the program that warranted support.
We still don't have a new farm bill. As I understand, an extension, again, of the 2018 and discussion at some point of what House Ag Committee Chair G.T. Thompson calls a skinny farm bill. The simple question is, what's left? What's on the table for Congress to address that might help to bolster this program that farmers say is their do or die?
Well, I'm sure that commodity groups will look at where things landed, and if there's a role for crop insurance, there's definitely an avenue for those issues to be addressed, taken up, probably on the specialty crop side, although, again, going back to OB3, with respect to the premium support increases for individual coverages, that's available. There was also language in there that increased the payments to agents for specialty crop to further incentivize expansion there. So I think a lot of these things, there's a lot of little stuff that keeps morphing out to meet the risk management needs that are out there.
Plenty of discussion in Washington about waste, fraud, and abuse. Are there any additional funding elements that would maintain strong oversight and program integrity?
I think it's like $10 to $15 million additional on program integrity. And, you know, that's an area where the agency, if one looks back, the Risk Management Agency was one of the first government agencies to employ data mining strategies, algorithms, et cetera. And they have worked, RMA and the companies have worked on that for some time. And the idea is, you know, there are tax dollars at stake, and there are private dollars at stake, there are farmer dollars at stake, and every dollar should be accounted for. And there are a series of reviews and audits that companies undergo. It's a compliance function that has worked very well at the Risk Management Agency. And then another metric is the improper payments rate, which is measured for the program, and RMA and the companies have one of the lower improper payment rates throughout the government. So there is a strive for efficiency, and at the same time, these dollars are all important, and there's a fiduciary responsibility to take care of them.
Crop insurance can't change the economics of agriculture. Obviously, farmers are not going to be able to get a loan. They're not able to do other things without crop insurance. But at the same time, crop insurance can't change a negative balance sheet. If a crop doesn't cash flow, it doesn't cash flow. And there is a level here of risk that even crop insurance can't overcome.
Well, that goes back to the conversation surrounding the role of Title I versus crop insurance. So good old microeconomics, maybe the second semester, if price per unit is below variable cost per unit, that's a shutdown condition, okay? And that's not an insurance or an insurable risk per se. And that's a tough thing to say. It's a tough thing to listen, you know, as it comes out of my mouth. But to your point, if commodities can't cash flow from the insurance side of the table, the asset needs to be insurable and have value, right? So if the prices are such that it's uneconomical to grow a crop, that's, you know, technically not an insurance issue. Our job is, in the event, you know, of a loss, drought, too much moisture, et cetera, to indemnify that loss. And the indemnification should be sufficient to cover, you know, a good chunk of the farmer's costs, which is different from the price of the commodity needed to incentivize the farmer to grow the crop in the first place.
Tom, the industry is obviously changing with new technology. So from satellites to artificial intelligence, are these elements driving efficiencies that may help the crop insurance program, the AIPs and the agents and the farmers they serve?
Absolutely. Anything that makes us go bigger, faster, stronger is a benefit. It's a benefit to the farmer in terms of improved service, faster claims payments, etc. For the AIPs, they're paid a certain amount from the federal government to deliver this program. So to the extent they can do that with less expense and get more bang for their buck, they will employ those technologies. And this goes back to the strength of the system that we have here in the U.S. is if this were run totally publicly, then the ability to wake up one day and say, hey, there's a new toy that makes this process go faster. There's no need for government procurement. Companies can go out and employ those technologies and bring them online a lot more readily than had this been totally public supported. So yeah, satellite technology, anything that improves the measurement of how much liability is out there, how much loss, flying over prevented planting fields with drones, counting specialty crops with these technologies, all that stuff, it builds a better mousetrap.
Well, Tom Zacharias, we want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. It's a busy time. Agents across the country working with farmers to wrap up the 2025 season and also looking ahead to insurance coverage needs for 2026. Thanks for being here and keeping us up to date with the program. Thanks for the service that you provide. It is Open Mic, and today, Tom, you got the last word.
Well, we would just like to express our appreciation to the farmers that trust the crop insurance system, the hardworking men and women in the industry, and the support that has been garnered over the years from farm organizations, commodity organizations, and leaders in Congress and the administration that shepherd over us in this program. It's a good system, and we continue to build upon it.
Our thanks to Tom Zacharias, president of the National Crop Insurance Services. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance, family farming legacies, American manufacturing jobs, and our national food security need strong farm and trade policies. Learn more at sugaralliance.org. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.